Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 377th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doc and a professor at the University of Alberta in the Department of Family Medicine.
And we shall continue our journey down the marijuana route. And this will, I'm pretty sure this will be the last podcast that we'll do on medical marijuana or cannabinoids, or however you want to put it into perspective. For those of you been following along and remember, we sort of got halfway through our simplified guidelines where we talked about some general principles of the use of these agents and also talked about the use of it for neuropathic pain and cancer and palliative pain. And now we're going to talk about other conditions and then just give some sort of prescribing considerations or prescribing thoughts at the end.
Right. So let's jump right in. We don't need to go over everyone's who participated in the guideline. I encourage you to go look that up if you're keen. We said it on the last podcast. So let's jump into nausea and vomiting. And what we found really quickly with this, as we mentioned in the previous podcast, is it's almost all around chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. There's a little bit in palliative nausea and vomiting, which didn't seem to have as much of an effect, unfortunately, but there is good evidence in chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And so what kind of things do we mean by a good effect? Well, if you're looking for resolution or prevention of nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy, you're talking about attaining that with cannabinoids in 47% of patients versus 13% in the placebo. So that's an NNT of 3, which I think, James, you'd agree is pretty good.
Again, it's not everybody again, but the big difference is you can, when we talked about pain control, you know, we were talking about, you know, a placebo group response somewhere in the 30 to 40%, but now we're sort of in the 10 to 20%, if you will, right?
So you're seeing a better benefit here. And now there are caveats to all of this. There was inconsistency in these results. Half of the studies are quite old, meaning that with new medicines like ondansetron, we're probably not, it might not appear quite as effective if that was a background medicine. And because the placebo event rate would be better, we'd have less people with nausea and vomiting. And the median follow-up for these studies was one day. But all in all, there is some evidence, and I think it does allow us to say, if you're, you know, for patients normally who are on chemotherapy, they get a cocktail of medicines, but they have contacted, my patients have contacted me when they have breakthrough symptoms, particularly on call and those kind of things. And I've considered what other agents to give them. And generally I've gone towards the kind of neuroleptics like prochloroparazine, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But the actual research says that cannabinoids are at least as good. And in this case, the research is all around drugs like dronabinol, which isn't available in Canada, and nabilone, which still is. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a very, it's very reasonable to consider them in these. So let's get back to the recommendations, because I think that's kind of what we're spending a lot of our time talking about. So for general nausea and vomiting, no, because there's no research. We strongly recommend it against it for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy or hyperemesis gravidum, because obviously we don't know that it works. We know that there's lots of harms from RCTs and other areas. And then there's all the unknown harms that we really don't have a clue about for the unborn infant. So these are fetus. So so we recommend it strongly against it there. I don't really see where, you know, we talked about earlier, where's there some wiggle room when we say we recommend against? I don't really think there's wiggle room here. Like, I just don't think.
Well, certainly certainly not in pregnancy, but I think when you could argue that.
That's all I meant.
No. But I was just saying where do you, you know, I had a patient who was saying, you know, I've tried these other things for nausea, vomiting, and it just doesn't, nothing really works. And especially if they've said, you know what, I have tried smoke marijuana and it seems to help.
Yeah.
You know, again, if you can trust the patient that it's not, they're not just doing it because they want to smoke marijuana, you know, it's reasonable to think that it could have a benefit, especially given how potentially effective it is for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting.
Yeah, I agree that it is very effective for chemotherapy. Yeah. I wish we had better evidence for the other thing. One of the challenges is we know that there is a linkage between chronic cannabinoid use, generally recreationally, mm-hmm. and a kind of cyclic vomiting syndrome. We're getting better research for that all the time, mm-hmm. but we didn't see any of that in the RCTs, mainly because they just were too short most of the time.
But it is
a bit of a mystery.
And it's certainly not in everybody.
No, you know what I'm saying?
We're not talking that this occurs in, you know, the vast majority of people who smoke marijuana on a regular basis, but
it's a concern. But let's get back to, so what do we recommend with chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting? So again, not really first or second line agents. So I don't think that nabilone is generally part of most cocktails mm-hmm. for patients after their chemotherapy. But we did feel that for patients who are still having nausea and vomiting on the usual cocktail, that this could be considered for these refractory cases mm-hmm. of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. Again, a discussion of the risks and benefits. And because it's short courses here, obviously the risks and benefits will be more in favor of short courses of this to help with that brief nausea and vomiting after chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And then used as an adjunct. So
because I think the evidence for things like ondansetron and steroids and stuff is much stronger. And I would argue that they likely have less side effects. Again, no head-to-head comparisons, but...
Yeah, the only head-to-head we really had was with the neuroleptics, and in that case, the cannabinoids seem better. So
yeah, if I was to choose something that I wanted to compare it to, if I wanted to show that mine was better, I would go against the neuroleptics.
You're not saying that. That's...
I'm not saying anything, Mike Allen. I am not trying to suggest anything.
To be fair to the. Like a lot of this research is older anyway.
Yeah,
so there's some reasons why that was their comparison.
And but those agents are used.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so that's basically it. We're just saying, and if you're going to choose one, nabilone is your choice. Mm-hmm. It's less costly. It's and that's where all the research is basically.
Yeah. At least in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And dronabinol too, but you can't use dronabinol.
That's what I meant because of the availability in Canada. Yeah.
Yeah. But other countries, yeah, dronabinol seemed to be as good. We did a sensitivity analysis, couldn't tease out any differences. So let's look at the last thing, which is spasticity. Spasticity was mainly in MS and spinal cord injury. Most of the data is in MS, and the vast majority of it here is with nabiximols, the buccal spray. So... which is a combination of THC and CBD mm-hmm. As a pharmaceutical product. And what kind of benefit can we expect with that? Well, if you're looking at a kind of 30% improvement in spasticity, it's very similar to what we saw for pain, about 25% benefit here with placebo and about 35% benefit with the cannabinoid. If you're looking at a change in spasticity score, again, you start somewhere around a 6, you go down to around a 5 with placebo, and you go around a 4.5 with the cannabinoid. And if you look at global impression of change, that means are people really kind of self-rating, I feel better? It's 50% for cannabinoid versus 35% for placebo. So any way you cut it, it's having an effect. It's between a 10 and 15% absolute effect over baseline. So I think a reasonable option, and again, that was reflected in our guideline recommendation where we said, basically, again, not first or second line because other things have better evidence. They're less costly with less adverse events. But it certainly could be considered for patients with refractory spasticity and MS or spinal cord injury. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, we really had to recommend, even though they're costly, nabiximols first, because they had the vast majority of the evidence were around nabiximols. So really that is the key features of the guideline as far as
benefits.
Recommendations
yeah.
go. Yeah. And the key benefits and what agents we could recommend it for.
Mm-hmm. So now we'll just briefly touch on the harms. Like, we've already talked about that a little bit, but we can sort of put it into context.
We've talked about the harms quite a bit. So I think, you know, we've talked about how the potential, like, I've had people write me and say, how can you call feeling high a harm or euphoria a harm? Well, first of all, they shouldn't be the intended effects of these products, and therefore they're side effects, and we group those as harms. And it's also important to remember that while euphoria occurs in about 15% of patients, dysphoria occurs in a very similar number, around 13%.
Yeah, and some people's euphoria is somebody else's dysphoria.
I think there may be different people have different reactions, but people respond to those reactions very differently. So some people might hate the sedative effects, but others might actually appreciate it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's hard to tell, but I don't think anyone's going to really appreciate hypotension.
No. I just meant the difference between euphoria and dysphoria.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about this. So the harms are numerous, and I think they need to be. Now, if you're having people, like you mentioned earlier, James, who use this product regularly for recreational reasons and found that it benefited their medical condition, they would have already, in a sense, had what we would call in a trial a run-in. They've tried it out and seen that it doesn't have a lot of profound adverse events, at least not initially for them. And so they might be able to avoid some of that. So your patients in front of you may say, well, I don't get any of those. And that's the thing about adverse events. They don't happen in everybody. There are people out there who take Orlistat who don't get diarrhea.
Yeah, in fact, the majority don't.
Yeah, because they avoid the stuff.
It's not like 50% get, you know, intractable diarrhea. I mean, a good number do. But I think it's also, you know,
Before you go on, I want you to describe intractable diarrhea.
I will draw a picture and post it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but and also, you know, many of these sort of adverse effects, if you will, you know, if you were to assess them in a clinical trial that only lasted a day or maybe 3 or 4 days, they will be higher. There'll be a higher percentage than people who use it chronically, because you'll tolerate to these sorts of things. So, and like you said, if you talk about people who've been on it a long time, if it absolutely made them feel wretched, they probably wouldn't continue on with it. So you're going to get a biased sort of viewpoint if you talk to people who are on it. But, you know, many of these things where, you know, when you look at things like impaired memory, sedation, feeling high, speech disorders, that could apply to narcotics. It could apply to, you know, some of the sort of agents that are used for neuropathic pain. It certainly could apply to, for some people, some of the antidepressant agents and so on. So, you know, we have to always put that into a context.
The good thing about neuropathic pain medicines is they have a similar type effect, and like the chance of benefit is what I mean. And they have a similar adverse event profile. Like, you can look down that list and then kind of randomly select with your finger, with your eyes closed rather, pick one, and the two primary adverse events will probably be in the range of dry mouth and sedation.
Exactly.
Let's talk a tiny bit about smoked marijuana, smoked medical marijuana, because I think that's what a lot of questions are around. So to give you some context, some of the early work on this was drafted up and published as part of a number of different kind of recommendation documents in the CFP, at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and all sorts of great sources. And it was by a person named Kahan. And I thought they did a dynamite job writing this up, and we kind of, with citing them regularly, kind of stole a lot of their great content. But basically, what it says is that the highest ever used is kind of in studies is a 9% THC marijuana cigarette or joint, if you will. And I know you will, James, when I say if you will.
Yes.
And there are about 8 drags or inhalations off that joint. And so the recommendation is actually to start with 1 inhalation a day, and then progress to 1 inhalation four times a day, so spread out over the day. And that's kind of where they feel most of the pain benefit will come from, that low usage. And usage of a higher amount is likely more to have the psychotropic, psychiatric kind of effects of sedation and dizziness and all of the other stuff that we've reviewed.
So in other words, when you're describing starting with a low dose and so on, and when I sort of use that thing, you ridicule me, yet now you're doing that for this.
I want you to know that I never ridiculed you for the science.
Oh.
It was for my personal enjoyment.
Okay. Well, you've had a lot of enjoyment over the years, my friend.
I have. And so there's some key things here. A lot of patients are using a lot more than that. The half of a joint or marijuana mm-hmm. cigarette, it amounts for about 400 milligrams. People are often using 1 to 3 grams a day and can use up to 5. The a recent article published, I think it was in CMAJ, said that 40% of strains available through licensed producers of medical marijuana, 40% of them have 15% THC or higher. Mm-hmm. So if you do some basic math and you say, we were hoping that patients were going to use this as one drag 4 times a day, and what they could be using is up to at 9%, and patients could be using it at 15% instead of 400 milligrams, taking as much as 5 grams a day, you're talking about a 20 times increase in the maximum dose. And right now in Canada, anyway, there's real limitations on how the doctor can participate in that kind of dose finding or overuse or anything like that. Because once you sign the prescription for the patient to interact with the licensed producer, you really have no role in deciding on the ratio of THC to CBD, the amount used, how it's used, all of that. That's all decided between the patient and the licensed producer.
Yeah, and it is slightly different, although, you know, you know as well as I do that when, even if we were to write, you know, use this painkiller, you know, every 4 to 6 hours as needed, that's just sort of, one, it's kind of made up. But we, you know, the people will be using it the way that they find that it's going to work. And I don't think anyone is going to be able to tell you, well, this is the right dose for you. This is how long it will work. And it will vary how long it's going to work. So I think the concept that you've talked about exactly is right. You know, you start off with, you know, one inhalation and actually just see how it makes you feel. And then build up from that point of view. And realizing that your job is literally to titrate it to what works for you, as far as you get more benefit than you do harm. And literally, there's no one else who can tell you, which is why we do these sort of shared decision-making things. We just give you advice on how to deal with that.
It's improbable, though, that at the high doses, there's not some, at the very high doses, there's not some kind of secondary gain issues going on. I don't think that's necessarily
the case. Oh, you mean the secondary gains of, you know, feeling high and stuff like that?
Yeah,
that's right. No doubt about it. Yeah. But you know, I would suggest that, you know, for some of the things, especially when we're talking about, you know, maybe for, you know, palliative pain and so on and so forth, I'm not, you know, convinced that...
I'm not so worried about that.
And, you know, if it makes you feel better, because the key issue is not, you know, it's not whether or not you feel better. That's the key issue, is if doing that means you have to use it for years and years and years, and the problems of smoking marijuana and just smoking anything in general, that's the concern everyone has.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting going through a guideline process, and I'm sure most of you who are listening would understand this. It's interesting how whenever you talk about palliative care, that you need to reframe your thinking. And mm-hmm. And that's the great thing about working with a guideline committee, because even if you're kind of stuck in the mode of thinking about it from a neuropathic pain or whatever, you've got a committee who will help reframe your thinking. So this committee was great, by the way. Need to say that. One thing that I will comment on, which comes up a lot and I think is very important, is about driving after the use of medical marijuana. So the basic guidelines are no driving 3 to 4 hours after inhaled cannabis. 6 hours after oral ingestion, and 8 hours if any high was noted. So mm-hmm. if any feeling of euphoria or high was noted, then you can't drive for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't drive if any of that feeling remains. So yeah. you have to wait at least 8 hours. So a lot of patients may find that quite inconvenient, obviously. Yeah.
But you know what? I would say that that's the exact comment that we should make about if we give anyone some benzodiazepines or...
Oh, for sure.
Or if they've never tried an SSRI or a tricyclic or a narcotic or any of these things, because like you said, they do impair you. There's no, roadside test where we can test your blood and see what your, blood alcohol is in the same sort of way. But I think, we have to, there's nothing unique about this other than, like you say, you can get, quite impaired with this and high doses of many medications.
Yeah, particularly the opioids and things like you said, benzos. Like when I have patients who need to get a CT and they have a tendency to be claustrophobic or panicky, I'll often prescribe them something like a lorazepam beforehand. Yeah. And the first thing I ask is, who is taking you to this imaging?
Yeah,
who's
taking you to the hospital? And taking you back.
That's what I mean. You're thinking of yourself where you would just take someone and drop them off and leave. You're a kind man.
Yes.
James McCormick. Let's talk really briefly about the cost, because I think this may surprise a few of you. Now, I said at a session I was giving just yesterday, I don't think anyone, you could convince a single person in your practice to pay $500 a month for propranolol or that kind of product. But for Navolone, what we're looking at for a monthly cost is somewhere between $100 and $300, somewhere in that range. The good news is sometimes, or a lot of times, Navolone can be covered by different insurance policies, that kind of thing. Nabiximols are often not covered, and they are quite expensive. They can go from anywhere from kind of $225 all the way up to $900 a month for maximum use. So obviously very, very pricey. And then for the standard or typical use, and we mentioned earlier, we're targeting around 400 milligrams a day, but the average use right now of medical marijuana dried and smoked is between 1 and 3 grams. At that range, the cost is between $250 and $750, averaging out to around $500. If you took something like 5 grams a day, the maximum amount, you're talking over $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
But the average would be somewhere around $500. So, James, I know you've, when you're talking to patients and when you're in your practice, you know, if you said to somebody, this is going to cost you $500 a month, many of them would, if you're lucky, they'd be polite and not say anything and then tear up the script when you walked out of the room.
Yeah. Or in this case, they would just grow their own.
Which actually, yeah, that's part of the laws around this, as you probably know. So
yeah, and I sort of said that tongue in cheek, but I think we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, no more needs to be said. So that's kind of the guideline in a
I suggest we didn't really touch on the long term and serious adverse effects. I mean,
and there's a reason for that. Yeah. So. Because we did mention it in the discussion of the guideline, as you probably know, but we didn't talk. The problem is the evidence is mixed in a lot of ways for, let's talk specifically about, actually it was in the systematic review, but looking at something like the harms of smoked marijuana for lung cancer, that evidence, because it's so hard to do that research and to know if you're actually getting honest answers about long-term use, etc., the data ends up being quite mixed. So some will show harm and some will not show any harm.
But what I was saying is that, but I think it's important to say that, when it comes to long-term effects, especially of the, from a smoking perspective, tobacco smoking perspective, that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
It's important to know that we just don't know.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I was going to try and fill in what little we do know, but...
Oh, no. The problem
is... totally right.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you're totally right. We know very little about this, like its effect on your risk of COPD. There's definitely some studies that will suggest it does, and And maybe you can escape some of that with vaporizing and that kind of thing. But again, we don't really know. There are certain governments not talking about medical cannabinoids, but vaporizing in general versus smoking, and think that it's safer. But again, the research is not solid enough for us to make a real call on that, I think, at this time.
And also the long-term, you know, sort of either neurologic or psychiatric issues associated with chronic use of these agents. I mean, even that, we don't have a great feel for it. There is no doubt people, you know, it's like anything else. You'll always run into the 97-year-old lady who said, I've smoked since the age of three. And then you'll also have the people who, you know, said, I can't believe it. I smoked, you know, for 3 years when I was a teenager, and now I have lung cancer.
Or I have COPD. So we don't know a lot of these, the cyclic vomiting syndrome, the dependence. There's research on dependence that I think a follow-up study of a group of people who were dependent on cannabinoids met criteria for having cannabinoid use disorder. I think a third of them or half of them, like a third or something, I can't remember the exact numbers, were no longer considered dependent 5 years later or something. But we're still very much learning about this. And so it's a challenge for us as providers, as care providers to, you know, and clinicians to kind of walk this fine line between all the areas that we don't really know very well right now, the little bit we do, and patients' clear desire for this product.
Yeah. And I think the bottom line is, though, I mean, you could have, for the most of this podcast, we could have eliminated the word cannabinoids and inserted many names of many medications. I mean, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think the best way to just look at the use of cannabinoids in these people is, this is just yet another medication. So look at the best available evidence, use common sense, let patients titrate the dose to whatever seems to work for them, realizing just with many, many medications, we don't know the long-term side effects. You got to look at the cost, you got to look at the tolerability, all those sorts of things. And if you just treat it that way, instead of getting too hung up on, you know, anything to do with legal issues and so on and so forth, I think that's the approach. And you know, you guys, and especially you, Mike, I mean, you really championed this entire process. You know, we as much as we know, you can get this information from both a systematic review that was done and also these guidelines. So as much as we know, you guys now know, if you will.
Yeah, and it's a very tricky thing. We're going from something that traditionally has a recreational use, and we're trying to put it into context of a medical use. I think you can take a standpoint where you say, this is terrible, it's a recreational substance, why don't we think about it in the same way as alcohol? And we actually wrote a little bit on that, the idea that we need to kind of reflect on this a bit. But I'll give you that piece, but I also give you the idea that I showed you this relatively well done, or quite well done, study from the New England Journal on Dravet syndrome, which I think shows a benefit in patients. And therefore, you have to recognize that it does have probably some pharmaceutical roles as well. So we have to find that and walk that tricky balance. And as you mentioned, James, I don't have very many patients who are dependent on Elevil or anything like that, but it sure does carry a lot of other things like sedation and other problems with it. But I don't see this. I see this as having a lot of overlap with our opioid issues.
Yeah.
It's not that opioids have no place in the future of medical care, but we were maybe a little over-enthusiastic about their use and not recognizing the potential risks that come with them. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, and I'll just make one comment.
I just think we have to look at this in a similar light of our past mistakes and not rush in with too much enthusiasm, but also recognize that there are potential therapeutic benefits here as well.
And also recognize that you know, prescription medications are abused as well. You know, there's nothing special about that. You know, the and especially some of the medications, especially in the past, that have been abused, and as far as going through things like withdrawal. I mean, just look at the issue that we've got with SSRIs and the withdrawal associated with that.
Yeah, you know, and how many times have we been told by different products that they weren't dependent forming or they were safe? Or, I mean, we were told originally that Valium wasn't dependent forming. There was no way. Yeah.
Well, you go one step further back to that, barbiturates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's another safe product.
Yeah.
For sure.
And, you know, it's like pretty much like every new NSAID is much safer and then it isn't.
Yeah, until it isn't. It's safer until it isn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
So anything else you want to add, Mike?
Just that to check out the guidelines, because they do have patient brochures. They have them. If you're really keen on those old traditional brochures that are trifold, we've actually got a version like that for you. If you just want to have it easy and print it out and hand it to patients as a single page, we've got a patient brochure like that. We call that the e-brochure. And then we've got that one pager, which I think you'll find quite helpful in practice if you are interested in shared informed decision making.
Yeah, cool. No, so great job as always. And just as a reminder to people, if you like this sort of information, you're going to love our course in Vancouver. May 4th and May 5th. And can't guarantee you sunny weather, but pretty sure we won't have snow like there might be in Edmonton.
That's right.
So,
and James, you're going to do an interpretive dance this year, aren't you?
No, the entire course is that.
Good. Awesome.
You have not lived until you've seen the interpretive dance of how do you treat constipation?
Intractable diarrhea. The interpretive dance.
Oh, that one. That one's even better. Oh man. For those of you who are wondering, no, we did not smoke marijuana before this podcast. So Mike, I think, you know, we should probably just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.